Hi, and welcome to the JRB Podcast. I'm Abe Socha, your host and the editor of the Jewish Review of Books. Last spring, Professor Sarah Abravaya-Stein told me about a North African Jewish Olympic swimmer named Alfred Nakash. Nakash swam for France in the infamous Nazi Olympics in Berlin in 1936, and then again after surviving the Holocaust in 1948. When Sarah told me what happened in the 12 years in between, I knew that she had to tell the story for our summer issue and on this podcast. Sarah's one of the most interesting Jewish historians working today. She holds the Viterbi Family Chair in Mediterranean Jewish Studies at UCLA and is the author or editor of many terrific and important books, including Family Papers, A Sephardic Journey Through the 20th Century, and most recently, with her colleague Omar Boom, Wartime North Africa, A Documentary History. I enjoyed and learned from our conversation, which we recorded just before the Paris Olympics started, and I think you'll like it too. Welcome, Sarah Stein. Thanks for coming on.
My pleasure to be here.
Let's talk about your terrific feature essay in our new issue, which is about the 20th century French Jewish, maybe really Moroccan Jewish, maybe Algerian Jewish, we'll talk about that, swimmer Alfred Nakash, who had this, I mean, until you told me about it, I'd never heard of him, but had this heroic, tragic, improbable life story, but one which is also a window onto North African Jewish life in the 20th century, and so in some ways also typical. As I say, I'd never heard of him despite, you know, like getting Great Jews in Sports actually for my bar mitzvah present and reading it. How did you hear about Alfred Nakash?
Thanks, Abe. Well, it's interesting. The Great Jews in Sports entree is not irrelevant, I think, because whether we're talking about Great Jews in Sports or whether we're talking, and it sounds like a big leap, but whether we're talking about popularized histories of the Second World War, there are realms of Jewish histories that unfortunately have been so often elided and that are so often untold. And in this case, I'm talking about the realm of North African Jewish experiences of life, of sport, and also, as it comes to the story of Alfred Nakash, of the Holocaust. He was a native of Constantine, Algeria. He is a swimmer. In his teens, he makes a mark on the North African swimming scene, goes to France to train, quickly rises, we'll unpack this in a moment, but quickly rises to great fame with many winning titles, competes in the Berlin Olympics under the watchful eye of Adolf Hitler, the Führer, and returns to France, astonishingly continues to compete, and is eventually deported along with other North African-born Jews and the children of North African-born Jews living in France, deported to the Nazi death camps, to Auschwitz. And there his story takes extraordinary twists and turns, but he survives and astonishingly, after his survival, continues to compete, will come to be one of only two Holocaust survivors to ever compete in the Olympics. So it's an astonishing story, and all the more astonishing that for those of us, Abe, like you and I, who are fully immersed in modern Jewish histories, that it would have been relegated to the sidelines.
What was it like to grow up as a Jewish boy in Constantine in the early 20th century? How does a kid like that end up a swimmer?
Right. So my friend and colleague Joshua Cole has written a beautiful book about both life in Jewish Constantine, but also the kind of spasm of violence that seized Constantine in the period of Nakash's late teen years. But he was born in what I would say was a traditional Jewish milieu in a city in North Africa, like other Mediterranean and internal cities of North Africa that were undergoing dramatic change. So on the one hand, born and raised in a religiously observant Jewish family. On the other hand, a time of dramatic change. I write in the piece that French colonial control brings many things to Constantine. Of course, it brings violence. It brings the deprivation of rights to the vast majority of residents of Algeria who are Muslim. It brings citizenship to the majority of Jews in Algeria since the Crémieux Decree of 1870. By the time then that Nakache is growing up, he will be born a French citizen. His siblings will be French citizens. He will grow up in a community that is Muslim, majority Muslim, Jewish, and contains a population of Christian settler colonialists, we can call them, who some of whom were French, some of whom were from southern Italy, who themselves had been in Constantine now for generations. And the colonial presence in North Africa, while bringing an assertion of power, a deprivation of rights for the majority of Algerians, while bringing destruction of environment and religious cultures and many other things, also brings a culture of anti-Semitism and a culture of sports. So to grow up in Constantine is to grow up, if you are a young Jewish man, with an admixture of Jewish traditionalism, with a kind of French authority, with North African modernism, which embraces things like sport, but also music and other forms of popular culture. So it is a region, a city, a culture in transition. And for someone like Nakache, who displayed extraordinary talent as a swimmer, it is also a launching pad that will carry him to France, whose citizenship he holds, but where he will not visit until he goes to train as a swimmer after his talent is already recognized in his home region.
And he's schooled in French? Yes.
Yes, that's right. He would have grown up probably with an admixture of Arabic at home, a kind of modest level of ritual Hebrew, and French being the language of instruction, the language of state, but not necessarily the language of the street, which would have been Arabic.
And so when does he go to France? He wins some meets, presumably, in Algeria. His talent is noticed. He takes the next step, and the next step is to go.
That's right. He's 16 at the age that he wins the North African Championships in 100-meter freestyle. And it is the year of the riot against Constantine's Jews. By the time of that riot, he is already in France.
And in France, he becomes a champion, right?
France, he becomes a champion, and he is immediately visible on the national stage, the athletic national stage in France. From 1935 to 1938, he wins 7 French national titles. And then in the kind of next chapter of his life, after a pause from 1941 to 42, he wins 6 more national medals. He, in a period that is not deeply understood, he travels to North Africa to represent France in a regional competition. He competes in the 36 Olympics, the Maccabiah Games in Tel Aviv in 1935. So this is just simply an astonishing pace of victory for Nakache and a visibility for Nakache. But we have to remember that this achievement of prominence is taking place against the backdrop of the rise of fascism in Europe and indeed of fascism in France particularly. So even as he is winning a world record, July 1941 sets a world record in Marseille, already we can see that chaos has engulfed French Jewry. And part of what is so fascinating about his story is the way in which he can, for a time, remain seemingly aloof from political events, even with his great visibility, but of course eventually will fall prey to the fascist, you know, net which is spreading across the continent and into North Africa.
Let's dig in there. By the way, I just want to say you have this great line in the middle after recounting some of his triumphs in the water. You say, but this is a timeline as viewed from the water, and then there's the historical timeline, the timeline of Europe, the war.
Actually, Abe, before you follow up with the question, I want to dwell on it for a moment, because one of the things that I've really tried to do as a scholar of modern Jewish histories, and especially of modern Mediterranean Jewish histories, but not exclusively, is to think about what it means if we organize our timelines and maybe even our typologies along seemingly unexpected paths. So here, I'm really trying to write a timeline, a history seen and experienced from the water. I think it honors the lives as they were lived, and to think about a water timeline as guiding Jewish history, and not only Alfred Nakash's story, is really to honor how he lived as a swimmer, but also as a Jew and a North African. And I think I've experimented with that idea in other domains of my work, of upsetting the normal expected chronologies, to really think about what it was like to live and experience the modern era as an extraordinary person or as an ordinary person living in Europe or the Mediterranean or North Africa.
Yeah,
but I interrupted you.
That's important. It's 1939, and Nakash has to, as it were, step out of the pool. He's going to get back in, as you already mentioned, but he has to step out of the pool. What happens then? Let's take his life from that point.
Well, it's 1939. Only 3 years earlier, Nakash represents France at the Summer Olympics in Berlin. He helps France take fourth in the 4x200-meter relay. And as the war breaks out, well, actually, even as the war is pending, Nakash interrupts his training and joins the Free French Army. And he serves with two brothers, actually, in Algeria for a stint of 10 months. And he will be there until summer of 1940, when he will return to Paris, where he was living before his departure. And Paris is, of course, occupied at this point. So he has his pace in the water, his competition in the water has been interrupted once, and of course, not for the last time.
But that itself is already surprising, right? Because he's a prominent Jew, known as a Jew. He's swam in Tel Aviv at the Maccabee Games and so on. And he's headed for Nazi-occupied France. All the stories we know, you know, from the movie Casablanca to the flights of various famous and not famous people, is a move in the other direction. In fact, as in Casablanca, sometimes to North Africa as a route away from danger, or relative danger. So why or how does he do that?
It's an interesting question. And it actually brings me back to something that you asked me earlier, a question that I didn't really do justice to, which was how I found my way to his story. So let me explain that the way I found myself encountering Nakash's story and all its complexity was through an extended and still ongoing collaboration with my friend and colleague, Omar Boom, also at UCLA, through which we have written two books. The first called The Holocaust and North Africa. The second, published more recently, called Wartime North Africa, which is a documentary history. This documentary history seeks to depict the incredibly complex landscape of wartime North Africa, which is so nuanced, partly because the region becomes home to an incredibly diverse array of actors. Obviously, we have local Muslims, we have local Jews, we have French colonial authorities, we also have representatives of the Nazi regime, especially in northern Spanish Morocco, and the Italian fascist regime. But as the war unfolds, and or even as the clouds of war approach, we also have refugees, opponents of fascism, those who volunteered for the Spanish Foreign Brigade in fighting against Franco's fascist powers, those who volunteered for the French Foreign Legion. In time, we will have those who will be arrested and interned by the Vichy French fascist regime and put in an array of camps across North Africa, prison camps, labor camps, internment camps, and more. The image we all have of Casablanca, of the eclectic body of desperate people gathering in Rick's Cafe, each more desperate than the other for paperwork, in some ways is illustrative because it shows us what a meeting place North Africa existed as during the war. But it's also very deceiving because in fact, what the Vichy regime did with people like that is intern them and send them to camps. Now, carrying us back to Nakache and the question of why he returned to Paris, I would say this. It is still an uncertain landscape. Not all Jews are fleeing. Some believe that factors can help insulate them. Maybe they were a veteran. Maybe they were the family of a veteran. Maybe they were famous in the case of Nakache. Maybe they had vast resources. So it is a time of great fear, but it is also a time of uncertainty. And I don't know from writing, from Nakache's own words, why he made that reverse voyage. But it is certainly believable that he would, first of all, want to be reunited with his family in a time of war, with his wife and his daughter, his infant daughter, sure, but also that he could not have anticipated what no one could anticipate, which was the violence that would follow. And finally, what I would say is that had he stayed in North Africa at that moment, it would not have insulated him from deportation. And indeed, there were Jews and there were some Muslims who were deported to the Nazi death camps from North Africa. Of course, there were many more who were deported from France, even though they held French citizenship or their children held French citizenship, and so-called native French Jews were largely protected from deportation. So I would say that it is a classic story that hindsight not only seems wiser, but is sometimes deceptive because it doesn't always indicate what the climate on the ground would have felt like.
Right. No, that's important. I mean, the complexity of wartime experience, which we forget when we think more generally, is really clear in Nakache's case. I mean, he sets a world record for a seawater course swimming in Marseille, right? And here I'm a little unclear, and perhaps it just is a little unclear, but I'll just ask you the question. On the one hand, you have major French magazines, Paris Match and others, you know, calling him a Jew or being coy about it or even making fun of him. We've got a great image of this Paris Match cover where they've caught him in this somewhat embarrassing moment with his tongue lolling out. They're both celebrating and deriding him somehow. You quote an anti-Semitic magazine that refers to him as, I'm quoting here, a supernatural man, this half-god with frizzy hair and wide nostrils, the Jew Artem, that was his nickname, Nakache, member of the Zionist Association, and then they misspell Maccabiah, laureate of the Jewish Olympics, et cetera, et cetera. So they know he's Jewish, and yet here he is in Vichy, France, swimming, so far not detained. Everybody knows it, but maybe pretends they don't. I mean, what exactly is going on, and how does this illuminate not only his life, but actually the life of Jews in Vichy France?
It is it's a very surprising story and a complex one. And when we think about this timeline and we think about why it is so unexpected, we have to remember that the Vichy regime a year earlier had begun to roll out its anti-Semitic and racist legislation, denaturalizing Jews in July of 1940 and beginning to implement its first anti-Semitic Jewish so-called status laws in the fall of 1940 that begin to exclude Jews from civil service and the professions and the army and industrial activities and many other things. So when you point to the world record of July 41, this is quite a long time after the intentions of the regime have been made known. And these anti-Jewish statutes, let's just pause to emphasize, are rolled out in France and in North Africa, in regions under Vichy French control. So here I think we have to reflect on sports and the idea of a national hero and the complexity of racial logic and racist logic. Was it easy to declare that Nakash was Jewish? Yes. His name was in fact visibly Jewish. He had taken part in the games in Tel Aviv. His birth records, his family records are extremely easy to access. And also for his wife, who is also a swimmer and is also Algerian-born Jew. So I think that the French main sporting organization and the French state will support its heroes, even if they fall afoul of racist assumptions, until they can support them no longer, because they serve them as tools of a form of propaganda of promoting the superior French body. That's the role that he, against his will, is pulled into in the Berlin Olympics. So he can be celebrated as a hero until both public opinion and the evolution of Vichy policy makes it that he can no longer be recognized as such. And that's why he is actually put on a podium next to French military authorities in North Africa while participating in this North African tour de force. Truly, it was a tour de force, a sporting tour sponsored by the Vichy regime through North Africa. And he will be celebrated for his achievements in Berlin and after. But I believe that it is once rumors about him begin to circulate that this ploy, in a sense, is no longer plausible, either on behalf of the French Swimming Federation or on behalf of the Vichy state. And so now we see that there is particular pressure being exerted on Nakash and on the relevant governing bodies to press Nakash to do what all other Jews have already been forced to do, which is define their Jewish status. And that pressure comes forward in early winter 1942 upon Nakash specifically, actually at the urging of the highest levels of powers in Algeria. But simultaneously, the anti-Semitic press in France is beginning to also point the finger. And his successes very quickly now become a point of humiliation for the state, that they are allowing a Jew to best French and also German competitors and allowing him to escape the racial restrictions and policies that by now other Jews have fallen prey to. Rumor is a powerful force for celebrities at this time. I don't think for a moment that he could have passed through the war without drawing any attention, but the timing of the attention that he drew and the outrage and the anti-Semitic press has a role in bringing to a head his situation.
So we're at this, perhaps we've even been avoiding, we're at the tragic point of his story. What happens in 1944?
Well, so forgive me if I back tick it just a little, another moment, if we delay encountering this dreadful turn of events just for a moment further. There is a famous episode that shows us how sports and fascism and state violence are intertwined that takes place in the summer of 1942, when the French police detain and intern more than 28,000 Jewish children, women, men, families, and hold them in the Velodrome, one of the most of Divers, one of Paris's most famous indoor stadiums, intern them there before taking them to the internment camp of Drancy, and from there deporting them to Auschwitz. How visible of a signal we are receiving about how sports and politics are inextricably intertwined, and indeed how the fascist project was also wrapped up with the history of sport. Sports remained incredibly popular under Vichy. Sporting events were thronged. So, and even after these arrests in Paris, the conversation about Nakash continues. Is he Jewish? Isn't he Jewish? Will he be forced to declare himself Jewish? Will he not? During that heated time is when he takes this tour in North Africa representing the Vichy state, which is just extraordinary that he should be representing the Vichy regime in his homeland, but he is. And then it comes August 1943. The French Swimming Federation bars him from competition. And there's an amazing moment where his teammates engage together in a demonstration against the fact that he is not being allowed to participate. And I write in the article that it's an extraordinary moment of public solidarity for a Jew that was very rare at that time in France or anywhere. And now things accelerate very quickly. The French militia, the milice française, is given a tip, probably by a competitor swimmer who was affiliated with that organization, but possibly by someone else. And with that tip, the Gestapo move in, they arrest Alfred Nakash, they arrest his wife, Paul, and their toddler, Annie, who had temporarily been housed first with friends and in a convent, but was back with the family. And they are all placed in a prison in Toulouse and then sent to Drancy and from there to Auschwitz. And Nakash's wife and baby daughter will be gassed immediately, which he will not know for some time, and he will be pressed into forced labor.
And as you write, forced back into the water as a form of torture or sport for the Nazi guards or both.
Precisely so. Nakash will be among other athletes who are forced to perform feats of strength for the pleasure of their Nazi captors. We know this to be true of boxers, for example, including the famous Tunisian-born Jewish boxer Victor Perez, who was also interned in Auschwitz. By some accounts, met Nakash. I'm not certain we know that with total positivity, but he will be compelled to box in Auschwitz as a prisoner. Nakash will be forced to, some accounts say swim, but really it's rather to dive in this small water tank, to dive after daggers or knives that are thrown in for him. So it is an act of humiliation and also a way of, I think, asserting Nazi dominance over not just Nakash's body, but the ideal body, over the idea of who can be virile, who can be strong, who can be an athlete, who can be a winner, and who is debased, and who is a victim, and who exists merely to follow rather than to lead. There are also accounts of Nakash finding illicit opportunities to swim in the water. I have read from other survivors' accounts, but it is also true that he is compelled to display his art, let's say, to display his greatest strength as a metaphor for his worst debasement.
Before we end, I want to get back to his art, that is, the way he swam. But you have this, as long as we're here in Auschwitz, you have this amazing line at the beginning of your essay. The first time Alfred Nakash died, it was in the gas chambers of Auschwitz. The second time, it was in the water where he was most at home. So did he die in the gas chambers?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. The French press announces that Alfred Nakash has died in Auschwitz. There are a series of
this
articles.
This is after the war or as the war is ended?
This is, well, it's in the chaos of the late war. This makes headlines all across the nation. But in fact, he had not died. Soviet forces are approaching Auschwitz. Inmates are being compelled to join death marches, and he is among them. He is sent on a death march to Buchenwald, and he does survive. So in the collection of documents I mentioned earlier, Wartime North Africa, Omar Boom and I include selections of the erroneous press releases that announce his death. But he did not die. He survived. He's sent on a death march. He eventually will make his way back to France, weighing 88 pounds. He will eventually learn of the murder of his wife and his daughter. He, of course, is in a state of trauma, but astonishingly, or perhaps not, within 12 months, he's swimming again and competing again.
That
and
is
so
astonishing.
It is astonishing. In 1946, he participates in setting a new world record for the 3x100 meter relay. And in 1948, so soon after his release, he is again competing in the Olympics, representing France in London, the first Holocaust survivor to compete in the Olympics, but also only one of two who will ever compete in the Olympics after surviving the death camps. The other is a Jewish weightlifter from Poland by the name of Ben Helfgott. So he survives, and I don't know if one could say that he immediately thrives, but he, I think, as a means of recovery, defiance, because it is what he knows best, he rises to swim again.
Wow. Well, perhaps this is the point then to talk about his swimming style. You're a swimmer and a surfer, as I know. We talked about how I thrash around inefficiently in the water. How did Nakash swim?
Nakash is incredibly muscular. He is fast and he is powerful. And what's interesting, and I sought help to understand this from one of my wonderful students by the name of Katrina Sommer, who's swam for the UCLA Bruins team. His stroke is astonishingly contemporary, even though swimming styles have changed dramatically in the decades since Nakash swam. But at the time at which he is swimming, certain strokes are going through a transformation. The breaststroke was one of his strong suits. And in the 1930s is a time at which swimmers and coaches led by the Americans are realizing, forgive me if you're not a swimmer and you're a listener, but for all those swimmers out there, are realizing that the arm return on the breaststroke is faster outside the water than in the water, where it will encounter less resistance. And that is what we know as the modern butterfly stroke of the arms. Nakash is among those who is popularizing this new form of breaststroke, where his arms will come out of the water, but his legs will continue what we know of as the traditional breaststroke. That won't change until the 1950s. So he is a powerful swimmer, an intimidating swimmer to his competitors. He's also an experimental swimmer who is joining others in playing with the body and with water and with water resistance and with hydrodynamics and power to transform the sport. He wasn't the first, but he was among those architecting a transformation in the sport.
And I guess it's precisely that stroke that the artist Mark Anderson is capturing on the cover. There's this great painting of him mid-butterfly, I guess one might say. I don't want to quite end here, but he didn't die in Auschwitz, and we're back in the water with him. Where did he die?
Well, as you kindly read from my opening sentence of the piece, he died where he was most at home, which was in the water. He is swimming in a port in France, in south of France. He's only 100 kilometers from the place of his birth, and he suffers a heart attack. He had by this time remarried, brought happiness back into his life. You kindly feature a very joyful picture of him with one of his nieces accompanying the article. And yet he chooses, on his death, that his gravestone will carry not only his own name, but the name of his first wife, Paul, and his baby, Annie, who had died in Auschwitz. So even in death, he carried that trauma and maybe also that desire to vindicate the past and to mark what was lost, not only through swimming, but ultimately in stone and in a kind of print.
Before we wrap up, is there something that you feel we haven't touched? I mean, I'm really excited about this piece, in part because I'm excited about the Paris Olympics in just a couple of weeks, and to watching, you know, these fantastic swimmers, Ledecky, the new French hero, Marchand, others. But I have this sense that there's something that may not even be in the article that you want to say about sports and history, let's say, or the Olympic spectacle and 20th century experience. Perhaps that's a good way to wrap up.
Well, I love watching the Olympics too, and I will watch the events unfold in Paris with excitement and also fear for the E. coli levels in the Seine. But I think the reason I was driven to write about Nakache and to write about him now was because we are turning our eyes to France. We are turning our eyes to Paris. And I think it is an appropriate moment to memorialize this forgotten chapter. And in a way, that's where we began with the forgetting, to memorialize this forgotten chapter. It's not only Nakache, it's not only North African Jews whose experiences of the Holocaust have been put aside, at least until very recently. But I think Nakache's story does open up a window on the ways in which the Olympics have this complex history of honoring elite athleticism, monetizing elite athleticism, and being accompanied by trauma, by doping, by boycotts, by massacres, by terrorism, by sexual violence and racism, you know, recently forced transformation of intersex bodies, bodies of women with high testosterone levels. Now we see this crisis of environmental despoliation in the Seine. So I think that one could tell Alfred Nakache's story as a triumphalist story. And I do not mean to deny him that triumph, which he deserves. But I also think we can use his story to think about the Olympics and the dark shadow of these games, which I think, you know, ripple through the history of this event. And I think of that ripple as being very much like the ripple of water disturbed. And it is water forcibly disturbed and water accidentally disturbed, one could say, that defined Akash's life. And that allows us again to think that a Jewish history told from the water is a fascinating prospect that lets us see and understand history differently than we might otherwise.
It's always fascinating to speak with you and to have your wonderful and deeply researched essays in the Jewish Review of Books. And
thank you, Abe. It's an honor.
Maybe for us too. And let's text a little during the Olympics, and especially around the swimming events.
Perfect.
Thanks
joyfully
again
and with some
for
skepticism.
Coming.
Thank you, Abe. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks again to Professor Stein for coming on. You can read her essay, Swimming Through History, and the rest of the issue at jewishreviewofbooks.com. The JRB podcast is a production of the Jewish Review of Books and was produced by Akiva Schick. Please subscribe to our podcast on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or YouTube Podcasts. Oh, and leave us a 5-star review. The algorithm likes that, and we'd appreciate it too. Meanwhile, keep reading.